This is Audible.
Harper One and Harper Audio present Three Questions: How to Discover and Master the Power Within You, by Don Miguel Ruiz and Barbara Emrys, performed by Christian Barrios. This book is dedicated to those who have chosen to be the heroes of their own story. It is dedicated to all peaceful rebels who wish to change their world. This book is dedicated to those who love themselves without condition and who let that pure love shine for the world. It is dedicated to those who lead with compassion, who dare to act kindly, and who will not be governed by irrational fear. This book is dedicated to all women and men who act with courage and speak for those who cannot speak for themselves. It is written in honor of those who use their words to deliver messages of love and respect. With heartfelt thanks to our readers, Don Miguel Ruiz and Barbara Emrys. Introduction. 1. The Three Pearls of Wisdom. One rainy day, long ago, an old man was driving his wagon down a country road. The road was filled with potholes, so the drive was difficult, and the rain only made it worse. As the wagon plunged into a particularly deep hole, a rear wheel broke off. Calming his horse, the old man jumped down onto the muddy road and began to struggle with the wagon wheel. He soon realized that the hole was too deep and the wheel was too heavy for him to lift. As he stood there, wet and cold, he heard footsteps running toward him. A farm boy was on his way home to supper when he saw the old man's broken wagon, with water flowing around it like a river. The boy was big, strong, and eager to help. Finding a fallen fence post, he stepped knee-deep into the muddy hole and propped up the wagon. Then he began fixing the wheel. While he worked, the boy spoke to the old man about his wishes for the future. He understood very little about the world, but he wanted to learn. He wanted to discover who he was and to find answers to life's biggest mysteries. He was going to be a man soon and wanted to know more about love. He said he often daydreamed about the wonderful things yet to come.
"Most days?" the boy laughed. "I'm not sure if I'm dreaming or if I'm awake."
The boy talked on, and the old man listened in silence. Within an hour, the job was done. The wheel was set securely in its place, and the wagon was back on the road. The old man, filled with gratitude, searched through his pockets for a few coins. Finding nothing to offer the boy for his work, he asked him if he would accept the three pearls of wisdom instead, assuring him that the pearls would provide more riches than any coins. As the sun pierced through rushing storm clouds, the boy smiled. He knew he could not refuse the man's gratitude, however it was offered. And after all, he had much to learn.
"Yes," answered the boy politely. "I am truly honored that you would share your wisdom with me, sir."
So the old man leaned toward him and began to speak.
"To find your way in this world, you need only answer three questions," the old man explained. "First, you must ask yourself, who am I? You will know who you are when you see who you are not. Second, you must ask yourself, what is real? You will know what is real when you accept what is not real. Third," the man finished, "you must ask yourself, what is love? You will know love when you realize what love is not."
The old man straightened himself, brushing flecks of mud off his coat. The boy removed his hat respectfully and expressed his thanks. He watched the old man climb onto his wagon and whistle to his horse. The wagon lurched, shuddered, and then began to rattle down the road. As the boy turned toward home, where supper was waiting, he glanced back to see the back of the wagon disappear among the evening shadows. 2. Opening the Door. Simple stories invite us to reflect on our own lives. One way or another, they represent everyone's story. If a story is good, it has the power to inspire questions and encourage us to look for answers. If a story is very good, it can get under our skin and dare us to see the truth. It can open new doors of perception. These stories leave us a choice: to be challenged by the truth, or to close the door and continue walking a familiar path. This book is for those who are willing to see the truth of themselves. It is for those willing to ask what is real and to go through unfamiliar doors. Life is eager to begin a new conversation with you. If you're willing to listen and to change, your world can be transformed. We humans are what we are today because of the way our nervous system has responded to light over millions of years. Our brains have become intricate, our capabilities diverse, and our societies complex. We've certainly made our mark on this planet. And yet, if we were asked what we had to show for humanity's years of evolution, what would we say? Would we say that we're free of worry and conflict? Would we say we finally understand how to be the best humans we can be? It would be wonderful to say that our beliefs no longer drive us to do terrible things. It would be great to say that our minds no longer wage their internal wars. It would be nice to say that humans have become far too wise to turn against each other. It would be nice to say that about our species, but we cannot. Not yet, at least. In an ideal world, humans get along with each other for their own benefit and for the benefit of humanity. In an ideal community, people cooperate in order to prosper, and they appreciate their good fortune. They value life and care for the land that nurtures them. Ideally, they respect themselves and everyone else. In an ideal family, children are made to feel safe and appreciated. Parents are inspired teachers and vigilant protectors. The elderly continue to be productive. Groups of people form societies, of course, but no society tries to undermine any other. Together, they build greater communities, and together they ensure the well-being of every citizen. In this world of our imagination, governments may still exist. An ideal government presides over a country with respect. Its leaders are wise and far-seeing. The best possible Congress is one that legislates with conscience and compassion. Its laws are clear and just, and the rules apply to everyone. In this ideal world, people are also able to govern themselves justly. What does it mean to govern ourselves? It means we are in charge of our own thoughts and responsible for our own actions. We refuse to walk blindly through life. We see exactly what is, and not merely what we prefer to see. We don't permit the past to take command of the present. We view our personal reality the way a great artist would, with an eye for beauty and balance. In an ideal world, we don't punish ourselves repeatedly for one mistake. We don't indulge in self-pity. We don't manipulate emotions. We don't gossip or seek out drama. In an ideal world, we have no desire to judge or to blame. We are not defeated by guilt and shame, nor do we inflict shame on anyone else. In other words, we govern ourselves in the same way we want to be governed. With respect. There is much more we could say about that ideal world, but it's important to consider why this world doesn't actually exist for most of us. Helping the world move toward its ideal expression is too great a task for a small book, but we can take the first steps on our own. Everything we build together as human beings begins with a little imagination. We may believe we are tragic victims of circumstance, but with imagination, we can take another perspective and see how unkindly we treat ourselves. With all its thoughts and judgments, the mind may seem like our worst adversary. But by imagining the mind differently, we can make it our ally. By modifying the way our minds work, we can begin to change our world. We all have fears we won't admit to ourselves, and we're not always sure how to overcome them. We need love, but we're not convinced we deserve it. We want to love ourselves, but we don't know how. To one degree or another, there is chaos and confusion in each of us. Ideas take hold, and opinions intimidate. We get caught up in our own drama and take it all so seriously. We play roles that don't reflect the truth of what we are. Why do we do this to ourselves? The answer is that we were shown how, and we became masters at it. Everyone is born an authentic being, but it is hard to remain authentic in a world where beliefs have already been assigned to us. As infants and children, we are told who we are, how we should behave, and how to respond to what we perceive. This is how families and cultures function most effectively, and how children survive within their cultures. But that doesn't mean these lessons are rooted in reality. You could say that our early training teaches us to deceive ourselves. We learn to lie. Life is truth, and only life exists. By using words to describe the truth, we automatically distort it. So a lie is simply a distortion of the truth. There may be no malice intended, but we still use lies against ourselves and against each other. We all know how little kids say the funniest things. Funny, because they speak the truth as they perceive it, without judgment. Honest insights, plainly spoken, sound pretty shocking to adult ears. Why? In many cultures, stating an obvious truth is considered impolite. Honesty and authenticity are sometimes thought to be childlike qualities. At times, they might even be considered crazy. Most of us have learned to lie about what we see and how we feel. By the time we've reached adulthood, we've even learned to believe our lies. Growing up, we develop strong minds. But minds can become corrupted. We form strong opinions, but our opinions don't represent the truth. Emotional responses become corrupted when they are ruled by opinions and beliefs. We were created by a loving force, but we even learn to corrupt love. Corruption sounds like a willful crime, but people don't come into the world with corrupt intentions. We were born hungry for the truth and eager to love. Corruption happens when we put our faith in thoughts and ideas instead of what we perceive. We believe most of what we're told, and in the process, we lose our connection with life, with truth. We create rules and structures that conform to what we've been taught to believe. Love is one example of how our natural impulses can be poisoned by ideas. Too many of us were taught that love is conditional, that it comes with specific rules of engagement. To put it simply, love is corrupted by if. We may not always hear if spoken out loud, but we sense it often enough, even between people who are devoted to each other. I will love you if you do what I want. I'll love you if you stand by me, no matter what. I'll love you if you do this or believe that. If you embarrass me, disagree with me, or leave me, I will stop loving you. Amazingly, we say things like this to the people we care about most, just as we say them to ourselves. Yes, we set conditions on loving ourselves, conditions that are often too strict to meet. Real love comes with no conditions. And yet that's not how most of us were taught to offer love and to receive it. When we think of love as conditional, it becomes something else, something corrupt. Of course, this kind of corruption can be repaired, because it begins in the virtual world of the mind. Virtual reality is a reflection, an interpretation of what is real. The mind gives us an impression of everything we can touch and see, but it's an impression. Ideas aren't made of matter. Beliefs aren't part of our genetic makeup. The mind isn't actually real, and the fanciful world it creates doesn't actually exist. So what is the mind, and what does it do? The mind is a function of the brain that turns perception into language. The ways we describe reality are unique to each of us. You have your way, I have mine. The difference depends on how our brains work, of course. It also depends on how we've been taught to perceive the world. When we see an idyllic scene, such as a mountain range, green meadows, and open expanses of wilderness, some of us think of paradise. We react with excitement and pleasure. Others, seeing the same scenery, imagine extreme hardship and loneliness and react in fear. Where some see tranquility, others see disturbance. If we were taught to be afraid, we will likely continue to be afraid. If we believe that unfamiliar things are dangerous, we will avoid new experiences. We were taught to interpret what we see. We were told what to believe, and believed what we were told. We've been guided by private and public opinion since we were born. Reality is made of impressions and experiences to which we give personal meaning and value. It changes constantly, of course, since events keep changing. Our personal perception of reality is affected by our opinions and our fears. Many beliefs encourage fear. Many beliefs are influenced by fear. Fear has had a big effect on the way we learn to view the world. Physical fear is natural and essential to our survival, but it's important to remember that irrational fear is not. It is irrational to be afraid of what doesn't exist. In fact, it can cause actual harm. And yet we've learned to let irrational fear shape our reality. We've learned to react emotionally in ways that other people do, and to fear what we only imagine. These reactions took time and practice to perfect. We followed the rules of our families and cultures. Our parents and teachers showed us how to behave in a world of humans, and we took those lessons with us into adulthood. Now we tell ourselves how to behave in much the same way. We follow the rules of society, but we've applied most of society's rules to our own lives. We rule ourselves through self-made laws, personal judgments, and mental intimidation. As children, we observed how our own family and our local community were governed. We followed the protocols of school, church, and the front office. To go against the rules usually resulted in a loss of respect among our peers. Sometimes the losses were far greater. We obeyed the rules of our city and state governments and the laws of our nation's government. Breaking those rules meant paying bigger penalties. All of this influenced the way our minds work. And so you could say the way we run ourselves mirrors the way things run in the world. It's no surprise that we all have a little government operating in our heads. The mind is the government that sets the rules, and the physical body follows those rules. We're willing to pay real penalties for breaking the rules we put in place, and very often, we make someone else pay as well. Like most governments, the mind tries to impose its laws on other bodies. When we are aware of the way the mind functions, we can alter the way we rule ourselves.
When we see how our own little government works, we can change it. We can amend our own laws. Whatever we're able to imagine for our own sake, we can create. We can become better caretakers to our bodies and allow ourselves more freedom of expression. We can end the strict penalties we've inflicted on ourselves. Penalties that make it impossible to experience the love we deserve. We all want to be the best humans we can be. We want to contribute to our own personal evolution. We want to know what we've been doing wrong and what we could do better. We want our secret questions to be answered and to see how the answers can be applied to our own lives. We'd like to discover what is true. We can all use a few pearls of wisdom. Wisdom improves our relationship with life, with truth. It allows us to rise above our fears and our common beliefs. It gives us the will to walk through one new door and then the next. The journey begins with three essential questions. Who am I? What is real? What is love? Ask yourself, who am I? 3. The first pearl. Who am I? You will know who you are when you see who you are not. We think we know all there is to know about ourselves. You may believe you're the reliable one, the optimistic one, or the melancholy one. You've probably decided you're either an introvert or the life of the party. Sometimes we experience a disturbance of some kind in our lives, a trauma or a loss. Seeing ourselves in action during a crisis, we're sometimes shocked. It could be that we never imagined we could be so strong. Or maybe we're weaker than we expected, or more fearful. There comes a time in most of our lives when we're ready to admit we are not who we thought we were. In such cases, it could be that the values we defend aren't reflected in our actions. We're in conflict with people around us. Our minds are in conflict with our hearts. We blame or we lash out. We shout at our kids. We insult a friend. Where did that come from? We ask ourselves. Confused and discouraged, we begin to wonder what makes us do the things we do. We wanted the truth, but seem to have missed something in our search. Asking yourself, who am I, means taking the first step back to authenticity or truth. Our instinct is to cling to the picture we have of ourselves, which makes any new discoveries impossible. Questioning who we are gives us a chance to bring down a few walls, a few stubborn beliefs, and reconnect with life. Most of the stories about who you are come from things your parents told you. What you like, what you dislike, or what you're good at. You heard more opinions from brothers, sisters, and childhood friends. As you grew up, you got descriptions of yourself from everyone you met. You're the smart one, they might have said. You're the rebel. Or, my, you're just like your father. People still like to imagine you in their own way. You're so stubborn. You don't know how to love. You never take risks. By now, you've formed a solid opinion of yourself. But consider what that opinion is based on. Since you were born, you've heard different people describe you many different ways. They each see what they want to see, and you've supplemented other people's stories with stories of your own. When you meet someone, you talk about your life, past events and hopes for the future. You tell the same stories, more or less the same way, featuring yourself as the main character. How did that character come to define you? Let's first look at how we tell our story
and then we can see how the main character describes itself and drives all our actions. We are storytelling creatures. Telling a story is a good way to connect to other people. Most of us don't think of ourselves as weavers of myths, but we never stop telling the story of our lives. We recount the events of each day as they unfold for anyone who will listen. We tell stories to ourselves as if to explain what we've already experienced. We talk nostalgically about yesterday and speculate about tomorrow. Some stories we tell often, inventing dramatic interpretations and new plot twists. And why not? Telling stories is what humans do. You probably don't put faith in fairy tales anymore, but you believe the story of your life. Most of us put a lot of faith in our version of reality. We talk about the events of our lives reverently, describing them in careful detail. We put on a performance for an audience of one, or many. If we stopped to listen to ourselves, we'd also realize how masterfully we play with emotions. If we took the time to write down the story of our lives, highlighting its most important moments, we'd see how easy it is to fall into our own emotional traps. However, if we wrote it all down a second time and a third, those moments would eventually lose their power to move us. We would begin to see just how much we are shaping our story to emphasize the drama. Even the best stories lose their emotional impact after the first telling. When we're finally able to disarm the emotional triggers in our own story, we can recall any event without the usual self-pity or self-importance. We can talk about today's problems and yesterday's mishaps without the need for sympathy. If we ever read our story out loud, we'd begin to see it all as a work of fiction, a work of art. And we'd realize that even our best stories don't tell the truth about us. So if that's the case, then who are we? As the old man in our little parable suggested, we'd be wise to first take a look at what we are not. 4. The voice of me. Ever since you can remember, you've given the main character of your story power to determine your reality. It has the authority to talk, think, and make decisions that affect your body and your world. It tells you what to believe and how to invest your beliefs with emotional energy. You call the main character in your ongoing story, me. Let's take a minute to understand what the word me means in this context. Me is the person you accept as your real self. You talk about yourself all the time, right? You say me, mine, and myself countless times in the course of an ordinary conversation. Through me, you say things like, hey, this is important to me, or are you listening to me, or what are they saying about me? Me is everything you believe you are. Me is everything related to the character you forged out of core beliefs and countless experiences. The word me, or its counterpart in any language, is a simple pronoun. And like every word in the language we speak, it has no meaning until we agree upon a meaning. The difference is that me comes with a lot of baggage, past memories, judgments, and automatic assumptions. We put a lot of faith in our identity and expect it to matter to other people. Who we think we are develops into a mythology. We share the myth of me with old friends and new acquaintances. We tell riveting stories about ourselves. We send photos to back up our stories. We celebrate me in so many ways. Me always refers to the person speaking, but we don't give much consideration to who that might be. We say, look at me, indicating that we want attention given to this human being,
but also to this thought process, these frustrations, these expectations. We feel sympathy for ourselves, but to the one listening, "look at me" could evoke other emotions. Our idea of who we are isn't everyone's idea of who we are. It may not be anyone's idea. "Me" doesn't refer to the body we occupy. "Me" doesn't describe the energy that moves through us. "Me" isn't a primal thing, because we didn't invent a self until we learned a language. "Me" didn't exist until we began to see the world through symbols and their meanings. In short, "me" doesn't refer to anything real. It refers to an image, an idea we have of ourselves that we've attempted to put into words. Of course, the words we use to describe ourselves change all the time, because we see things differently with every changing situation. Who we think we are has evolved a lot since early childhood, when we first began to talk and think. Who we imagine ourselves to be still changes, with time, with shifting moods, and with the feedback we get from people we care about. Our impressions change, but we each subscribe to a general myth or false belief about ourselves. "Me" is a personal mythology, a collection of stories that we repeat to ourselves and accept as truth. Like children with their superheroes, we are believers in "me." Wrapped in our mythology, we feel confident to take on the world. "Me" is not what you actually are. You are life, or the energy that made you a physical being. Life runs through your body and makes it able to move, to love, to feel. Life's energy created your miraculous brain. It made a thinking mind possible and gave voice to its main character. Life is everything seen and unseen. Only life exists. There is only life and infinite points of view. Everything created by life has a point of view, and your body is one. Your mind is one. The human body develops according to its biological programming, but the mind evolves consciously, through attention and deliberate action. The mind is what we think we are, until we decide otherwise. The voice that speaks for the mind is us, until we recognize that it's not the truth of us at all. Of all the things we can accomplish as humans, this kind of self-awareness brings the most rewards. It can guide the evolution of the main character. "Me" responds to your name and knows your history. "Me" is aware of your physical environment, and "me" can also become aware of itself. Personal growth does get complicated when we try to distance ourselves from the character we created. Through "me," we describe ourselves and the world. If we claim to be the victim of the voice in our head, we'll be the victim in all situations. If we deny the power we have to change the voice of "me," how can new doors of awareness ever open? How can we live fearlessly within the dream of humanity, where there are more than 7 billion me's, all with opinions of their own and all demanding to be heard? Reality is everyone's personal creation, so the same is true of your reality. The judgments in your head are the result of your beliefs and past experiences. If you feel oppressed by your own thoughts, then it's time to take charge of them. Does "me" have to be a big judge or a constant victim? No. Most of us want a closer relationship with the truth, and we all want some peace of mind. We want to be healthy, but so often our judgments make us sick. We want to be spiritually aware, but our beliefs keep us spellbound. If we take the time to listen to what we think and say, we have a chance to be more honest with ourselves. Behavior follows belief, and any belief can be modified. If we challenge our own opinions, we can begin to find our way back to authenticity. Do we always have to be right? Do we really need to have the last word? If our actions do not represent the kind of people we want to be, we can take new paths of action. We can change. It makes sense that the more we invest in our own self-image, the more difficult it is to change. So we shouldn't use the main character of our story as an excuse to feel victimized or to deceive ourselves. The truth can speak through the mind, just as it moves through nerves and flesh. The mind can choose to serve truth and not the stories. Life's energy uses the tools available to create a body, a thought, or a dream. A healthy body is a wonderful conduit for energy, and an aware mind is the secret to making our reality work for us. Your body is real, but me is fictional. And yet me is running the show. How many times have you defended your actions and not understood why? At times, we all regret doing things we consider inexcusable or saying things we don't really mean. We like to say, "I'm only human." But it's not our humanness that's causing the problem. So it's natural to wonder who really is in charge. Who am I? We wonder, not really expecting an answer. No one stops to ask who they're not. And that's where we have to begin. Be aware of yourself as energy, and everything changes. Here is how that works. You are no longer the victim of your beliefs. You are the creator. You are the artist. You are also the painting, the canvas that is your reality. Imagine picking up a brush and painting a figure that looks like you. Imagine doing that continually for the rest of your life. Unlike most figures in a painting, however, this one has a brain. It has a brain with a mind that gives meaning to what it perceives. It functions beautifully, but it's not aware that there is an artist. There are many other figures in this painting, but they're also not aware of the artist. This makes it inevitable that they rely on each other for knowledge. They react and interact with each other. They learn from each other. Every day the scenario changes. Instant by instant, there are subtle changes happening to the painter's main point of focus. The figure itself is coming alive at your touch. You not only have colors and brushes to work with, but you can make choices through this character. You can work as life works, providing constant opportunity for growth, so that the main figure adapts well to an ever-changing landscape. You can skillfully guide me into awareness. Some people dare to look inward. They take the time to listen to their own thoughts and reflect on their own actions. They ask questions of themselves. Am I really this kind of person? Are these feelings genuine? If I'd known I had a choice, would I have done it the same way? They catch themselves in mid-reaction and change the response. They find emotional balance. That's what it means to be present. That's how we become healthier in mind and spirit. By observing, we can all learn. By modifying the voice in our heads, we have a chance to grow wise. Some people stop believing their thoughts altogether. This is important because once the voice in our head loses authority, it turns silent. We can observe events and respond genuinely. We're used to reacting in expected ways. We're used to seeing things as we've been taught to see them, as we've preferred to see them. Once we stop lying to ourselves, all that is left is truth. All that is left is authenticity, something we lost in our storytelling. Throughout human history, people have been wondering, questioning, seeking. Some of those people have changed the world, not just their world, but the entire dream of humanity. They begin by doubting what they know. They ask one question, then another. They consult wiser men and women, perhaps. Soon, they start listening to the main character of their own story. It has a voice that speaks clearly and only to them. What is it saying? And how much of its message is true? Can any of it be believed? For that matter, what is the truth? What is real? We have a few amazing tools to work with when it comes to solving the mystery of who we are. The first tool is the power of attention. Our attention is what makes it possible to take notice and to learn. The sound of our name captures our attention, a response we learned in infancy. Attention brings every other faculty into play. We look, we listen, we respond. We receive information, and we process it. And by catching another person's attention, we learn to transmit information to someone else and out to the world. Over time, however, we've mastered the art of sleepwalking through life. We don't think we need to pay attention because we're sure we know what's going on around us. Our responses to everything have become predictable. Our thinking is automatic. And we automatically assume we know what other people are thinking. It's safe to say that our attention has been weakened by neglect. What if we rediscovered its amazing power? We'd have minds that are agile and flexible when events change, and change is inevitable. There's no need to be crushed by failed expectations. If we used our senses to gather real information, we wouldn't be so mystified by life. If we really listened, not only to what people are saying, but also to what we say to ourselves in quiet moments, we would empathize with others so much more and show compassion toward ourselves. Instead, we make assumptions and encourage misunderstanding. Strengthening our attention may feel like a workout at first, but the rewards come quickly. The brain responds eagerly to new challenges. Look, listen, and observe without judgment. Notice how your emotional responses become more honest without a story. Attention can lead to total awareness in every precious moment of life. The second tool is memory. Memory is stored in matter, our brains, the way music is stored on a compact disc. We're able to store all the memories of a lifetime in one brain, but that doesn't make those memories real. We store impressions of things, people, and events. But since every brain perceives in its own way, even siblings remember childhood events differently. Memory helps to create an impression of reality, but impressions aren't the same as truth. We rely too much on memory to tell us the truth. We let it turn our attention away from the present moment and draw us into the past. We frequently use memory against ourselves, but we have the power to use it differently. Instead, we can let memory enlighten us. Just as memory played a key role in our early development, it can guide us in our adult transformation. In infancy, we watched our parents. We listened, and we imitated. Everything we observed became part of our own pattern of behavior. We tried to walk, we fell down, and we tried again. We learned to avoid pain and move toward pleasure. And what about now, when we wish to change some unpleasant patterns? Why wouldn't we do everything we can to take care of our physical body and our emotional well-being? We know how it feels to lose our temper and feel regret. It feels awful. We know how shame and guilt make us feel, and yet we still invite them in. Memory can serve us in our efforts to wake up and resist automatic responses. Memory can steer us away from abusive habits, encouraging us to stand up and walk forward with self-respect. The third and best tool is imagination. Imagination is its own kind of superpower. We picture something in our minds, and then we make it real. In fact, just by imagining something wonderful, The body feels comforted and energized. We can also imagine painful events and horrible consequences. By imagining the worst, we produce fear in the physical body and spread fear to other bodies. We imagine the future and tune out the present. Imagination is power, for sure. But like all power, it can be corrupted. Right now, we can practice using imagination in a valuable way. We can turn our attention to the exciting task of making ourselves more aware. We can use memory the way it was intended to be used, to keep us from repeating past mistakes. We can imagine things we've never tried to imagine. We can doubt what we know and let go of familiar stories. The mind wields enormous influence. It has developed habits over time, but we can change those habits. By using the tools available to us, we can calm the inner chaos and find peace in our virtual world. You're not who you think you are. In obvious ways, you're not the kid you were at 4 years old, struggling with unspoken fears. You're not the awkward teen, the rookie at work, or the young entrepreneur. You're not someone's significant other or your mom's favorite child. You're not the main character of your story or anyone else's, regardless of how long you've played those roles. And you're not actually the one you call me, who tries to speak for your physical body. You're not your mind or the set of laws your mind tries so hard to enforce. It has created an entire governing force out of those laws. But that's not what you are either. You're not really the little government in your head, but its laws nonetheless influence your actions and reactions. Sometimes that government seems tolerant. Sometimes it's blind and unforgiving. Either way, me is operating as its commander in chief. Now would be a good time to decide what kind of leader me should be. Now is a good time to take a look at your creation and to make inspired changes. We were all born to learn, to grow, and to become aware human beings. It was our intention to be the best we could be. Somewhere along the way, we got distracted. Our intentions were derailed. We forgot what it felt like to be authentic. It may seem impossible to escape from our own system of punishments and rewards, but that's not true. We can bring down the whole structure if we want to. It's interesting to see how each of us creates a personal reality. It's also interesting to see just how far we go to defend that reality. Rather than defend it, we can make it better. It takes a few basic insights to pull off a revolution. First, it's important to see how the system was put into place. It's helpful to see how we got here, wherever we are, and what we can do to change our world. We can explore ways to transform the one who's describing that world to us. Awareness is the ability to see what is, and it's never too late to open our eyes. 5. One mind, one community. To understand the governing mind a little better, let's first take another look at the ways in which we've been governed throughout our lives. We were each born into a vast community called humanity. Over many thousands of years, humans have created groups or civilizations all over the planet. We create groups in order to survive. We agree on certain rules, written laws, or ritual customs, so that order can be maintained within those groups. We establish governing bodies made up of respected men and women. We create cities and nations all run by their own government. Every nation is made of smaller governing bodies, and it all starts with the family. A family is its own little nation, traditionally composed of a man, a woman, and their children. A family cannot be defined any one way, of course,
A family is formed when people of different genders and ages come together in order to provide for the welfare and safety of the group. The group may consist of 2 people, 12 people, or many more. Together, they create a home, which is an extension of themselves. Every family is regulated by its own government. Families establish rules of conduct, rules that help maintain harmony within the group. Work hard. Look after each other. Respect your elders. They also devise punishments for breaking those rules. The head of a family makes key decisions, setting the rules and enforcing them. One parent may yield authority to the other, or both parents may share power equally, forming government within the family. You and I were born to different families and grew up in different households. The rules were probably different, along with penalties for bad behavior, but we were both domesticated using a system of punishments and rewards. From the time we were toddlers, we learned there was a price to pay for rebellion. Whoever served as the head of the family imposed the rules, using the power of authority. Of course, those in charge had other ways of persuading us. They might have applied physical punishments or psychological abuses. Sometimes all it took was the subtle power of suggestion. Using our own imaginations to control us, our parents often told stories about naughty kids getting what they deserved. "You'd better watch out," they cautioned us, using Santa Claus, the boogeyman, or dead saints to make their point. Parents tell stories to manage their children, to discipline unruly children they intimidate. To keep them from danger, they use whatever means they think is appropriate. Parents themselves are ruled by the strict lessons of their childhood. No one is above the law. Groups of families create communities, the next level of government. A community, like a family, is dedicated to the welfare of the whole. Every community has a leader, just as every family does, and that leader makes the rules regarding acceptable modes of behavior. Everyone in the community agrees to follow the rules, knowing they will receive some kind of punishment if they don't. When communities create alliances with other communities, cities are established. In a city, there are many more people who want to lead. The competition gets fierce, and governing becomes more arduous. Every city must choose a mayor and a legislature made up of dedicated citizens. Together, they decide on the rules of acceptable conduct and on various ways of enforcing those rules. Cities are ruled by their individual governments, and no one person, not even the mayor, is above the law. When cities develop partnerships with other cities, a province or a state is formed. Every state has its own government, which has its own governor and system of laws. Choosing leaders gets more complicated as societies get larger. Citizens find it harder to be active participants in their own fate. Governors administer justice according to state laws and enforce those laws through whatever force is available to them. No one, at least in theory, is above the law. States ultimately form a confederacy called a country or nation. Now the stakes are high for everyone. Different kinds of government leaders compete to rule the entire country. Once in office, they use the power of their authority and direct available forces to impose their rules. Enforcement doesn't always mean imprisonment or corporeal punishment. Governors may also use fear and imagination to manage their constituents. Like their parents once did, they might use threats, guilt, and shame. They may simply use little suggestions to influence people. By whatever means, they enforce the law. And they often find that they are not above the laws they've put in place. A leader of one nation may desire to rule other nations as well. This is how civilizations evolve, as societies become more complex and leaders expand their authority. Nations form bigger nations, and impose their laws on more communities and families. In some cases, nations lose power and get swallowed up. Maps are drawn and redrawn. Rules still continue to be made and enforced, with whatever means are available. It's worthwhile to remember how outside governance has played a continuing role in our lives. It's worthwhile because our personal reality reflects the ways we use the same governing methods to discipline ourselves. We've been taught to respond to traffic lights, signals, and sirens, because by not responding, we risk paying a penalty. We don't ignore tax deadlines or no trespassing signs for the same reason. In any country, life goes more smoothly when we don't challenge local laws. Challenging our own mental directives is another matter. Thinking that harsh judgment is somehow virtuous, we impose rules and sanctions on ourselves, rarely stopping to wonder why. Would it hurt if we relaxed our control a little? What price would we pay for being kinder to ourselves? We grew up under the influence of one governing institution after another. We all learn by observing, listening, and imitating. So it follows that we've devised a way to police our own happiness. We are afraid to lose control. We want to control other people without considering their freedoms or showing them basic respect. Too often, our system of governing gets in the way of our basic desire to communicate and to love. It's not surprising that our principles, the ones taught to us by our family and culture, often suppress us and put limits on our joy. Imitating them, we write our own constitution and execute our own punishments. We disparage ourselves, attack ourselves, and suffer the emotional pain. For reasons most of us have forgotten, we insist on denying our bodies basic pleasures. We often force ourselves to do what we don't enjoy, and we, sometimes literally, send ourselves to bed without supper. In the personal reality we've created, no one is above the law, not even us. Imposing our will on other people only pushes them away. Our laws aren't real. Our little government only illustrates who we are not. We're not lawmakers, doomed to enforce rules at the expense of our own happiness. Our minds and bodies are meant to be allies in the quest for a better relationship with life. By questioning our own rules, we can enjoy the freedom to act and react truthfully. We can start the journey back to authenticity. 6. The mind as government. Allowing the mind to operate like a government pulls us farther from what we really are. Devising laws and punishments is a job for outside institutions. It is what societies do, and even their success depends on a willingness to change what doesn't work. With all our private judgments and censures, we've each built virtual jails for ourselves. And that can't possibly make us happy. Our personal reality doesn't have to be a prison. It should be an artistic effort. When we think of it as a living work of art, we can modify the masterpiece as we go. We have the power to make better choices, keeping the welfare of the body and mind. By governing ourselves with respect, we can create harmony in every facet of our lives. Of course, it helps to remind ourselves what government was designed to do. The kind of government most of us are familiar with has three main branches: a legislative, an executive, and a judicial branch. All three have the overriding purpose of serving the welfare of the country. A system of checks and balances makes sure one branch of government doesn't act in ways that undermine the others. Our mind can work the same way, by checking the integrity of its own actions. Every branch needs to be accountable and transparent. The mind needs to be aware of itself and practice effective oversight. The legislative branch of any government is called Congress. Congress makes laws and ratifies treaties, and so does the human mind. The mind creates